May it please the court, I'm Stephen Rosenbaum, appearing for Noble Energy. The United States materially breached its offshore oil and gas lease with Noble. It is uncontested that that material breach triggered the common law of discharge with respect to Noble's contractual obligation permanently to plug and abandon the well on that lease. Under the Texas rule, common law principles are presumed to be read into statutory and regulatory requirements absent an evident congressional intent to the contrary. We submit there is no such evident intent in either the OCS Lands Act or its regulations. There is no regulation that addresses the consequence of the government's material breach of the lease. Under those conditions, we submit that the Texas law principle means that
the common law loads the dice, doesn't it? That's the issue.
Sorry, sir?
You said there's no regulation that addresses the consequences. I said that sort of loads the dice, doesn't it?
Well, the Texas rule says that common law principles are to be read into regulatory and statutory requirements absent a clear intent to the contrary.
Is there a common law principle of discharge from regulatory obligations?
Well, the Texas rule consistently takes common law principles that arise in contexts other than regulation statutes and applies them to regulatory and statutory requirements.
But here we have the government arguing that there's an independent basis for the action that they've required, right? That it's not rooted in contract. It's rooted in the power of the sovereign to govern. Is Texas, Texas cases address that?
It is not a question of the government's sovereign power. It is a question of how one interprets the regulatory and statutory scheme that has been put in place. In other words, it would be within the authority of the United States government to establish by statute or regulation a specific provision that says, notwithstanding our material breach of the lease, you must do X, Y, and Z. We're not arguing the scope of the government's sovereign powers. We are arguing the question of how one interprets what the government has actually done and whether one applies common law principles to the obligations that exist in this context. And that is no different, we would submit, than many other cases where the Texas principles have been applied. As an example.
Can I interrupt you? The reason I said it sort of loads the dice when you said, and the hypothetical you just gave, if the regulation had read, you know, even if the government materially breaches this lease or this contract, you still have to permanently plug this thing when it's decommissioned, right? But how do we know that the regulation doesn't mean that? I mean, if the 1700 series of regulations don't make any exception for anything.
And the standard is that the regulation must speak directly to the question and make it evident that the intention was to change the common law.
Let me tell you what my problem with your theory is. Number one, Section 1 of the lease incorporates all statutes and regulations. Number two, the 1700 series of regulations were on the books at the time the lease was entered into. Your theory that if there's a material breach, you're discharged from all responsibilities, means that you're discharged, I take it, from the incorporation into the lease of all applicable statutes and regulations, right?
Well, whether there has been a material breach, of course, would depend in part on that provision.
But does that mean, how far does this go? For example, one of the requirements is that, suppose you had a platform out there.
Yes.
And as soon as the government materially breaches it, then does that mean that you don't have, the platforms have to be manned and crewed by American citizens or nationals with lawful permanent residence or aliens with lawful permanent residence? Does that mean immediately that you don't have to man or crew the platform anymore with the, in compliance with the, number one, the immigration laws, number two, the Outer Continental Shelf statute?
Well, I think there, under emergency conditions, if one were to declare a material breach and there would be a finding there had been a material breach, then
all applicable statutes and regulations you're discharged from responsibility under?
Well, you are discharged from your future obligations that you assumed when you entered into
that. Does
that
mean
lease?
That you can discriminate in violation of Title VII on the platform, because that's an applicable rule and regulation, statute and regulation?
Well, I think it would have to be an applicable requirement that was tied up into the underlying lease obligation. I don't think that
all of Part 250 is precisely that. Is it not? That is to say, it's a whole set of regulations governing the lease-lessor relationship.
And that is exactly, and that is why we believe this case is a particularly strong one for the application of the Texas principle.
But your theory is not limited to that. That Section 1 of the lease says all applicable statutes and regulations. That includes Title 7. It, because the United States has asserted jurisdiction out on the continental shelf, it includes the immigration laws, it includes manning and crewing, and in fact, it includes the Internal Revenue Code. I mean, you can't possibly maintain that if after a material breach that you're thereby free, if you're still producing some oil, free from having to pay federal taxes on it.
Well, no, I wouldn't submit that at all. Those are entirely independent requirements that are not
But the government says this one, the plugging after decommissioning, is an entirely independent requirement,
But if one looks at the language of the regulation, it arises entirely from our status as a lessee. That's the way the regulation reads.
Drilling. I mean, there are about five or six different requirements, one of which is if you drill a well, you're liable to plug it permanently.
If you're
in fact, in that regulation, being a lessee is one of the situations that triggers the requirements, but there are others as well. Drill a well, install a platform, create an obstruction to other users. I mean, drill a well doesn't apply to you?
Well, the requirement, yes, of course, because we're the lessee, so we drilled the well. The requirement applies to lessees and
but the regulation applies, you're saying, because you're a lessee. I'm suggesting it applies for other reasons as well.
The language of the regulation refers to lessees or those with operating rights in the leases, and which is essentially synonymous with being a lessee. And it would only be those obligations that arose unique.
The operator would be the agent of the lessee, right? Or at least, perhaps not agent technically, but at least would be contracting with the consent of the lessee and doing what he was doing on behalf of the lessee.
Absolutely, and of course with approval to play that role by the government. Judge Randolph, I certainly agree that requirements that adhere entirely independent of status as a lessee would continue to apply, but here, in the context,
I don't know how do you define independent? If you're producing oil, is that independent of the lease? And if you have to pay taxes on the production, is that independent of the lease? Are the taxes independent of the lease? I don't think so.
Our status as a lessee arises under and through the leasing statute, which is the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. That is the act that establishes our relationship with the government, that establishes bilateral obligations, and under which we obviously agree to assume responsibilities like plugging abandonment in return for our right to produce, to find the oil, and if we find it, to produce it. It's a quid pro quo, and these other obligations are not part of the. I mean, our obligation to not discriminate, that's not part of a quid pro quo. Our obligation to plug and abandon is, and it's the very rights that we were denied, namely to explore and develop and extract this oil and gas, that was the cause of the material breach. Under those conditions, where obviously our garnering money to pay for these activities is through the development of the resources, and we were denied that, under those conditions, these are sufficiently linked that it's appropriate, in our view, to apply the discharge rule.
May I ask you, in the proceedings in the Federal Circuit and the Court of Claims, was there a taking claim here?
No, there was not a taking claim. It's the case law is not generally supportive of takings claims in this context.
Because why?
Because there's a contract. And that's what the case law generally supports in most circumstances.
And the government, this sovereign acts doctrine that the government did not, according to Judge Bryson's opinion, did not rely upon that in the Federal Circuit, but is relying upon it before us.
That's accurate.
Yeah. Is there any collateral estoppel claim that would prevent them from doing that?
I don't know that we're arguing collateral estoppel. I think the sovereign acts argument misses our point, because our point is not a question of what could the government done had it written its regulation or its statute in a particular way. Our argument is that given what it did say, it did not say anything sufficiently clear to indicate the discharge rule would not apply if they materially breached the lease.
See, one of the ways that I find profitable to look at this, and you may disagree, is the question is, what is this regulation, the 1700 series of regulations? If in fact they mean what you suggested in your hypothetical, that regardless of anything, if you drill a well, you're going to have to, and you abandon it, you've got to plug it. Period. End of story. If that's what they mean with no qualification, then it follows that the discharge rule has no application here, because the regulation stands alone. On the other hand, if it means you only have to plug a well if the government doesn't materially breach your lease, then you win. How do we choose between the two meanings? The government has this Chevron argument, which I don't think is very persuasive. I don't see any official interpretation of this particular regulation dealing with this issue. Do you?
No, there's not. We don't think Chevron has any relevance. The Second Circuit in the Mader case said the burden of proof is on the party arguing that the common law root principles are not incorporated. That they say that's the burden in cases applying the Texas rule. So if this court agrees with the Second Circuit on that issue, which we think they should, then the burden is on the government. The other principle we bring to bear is that the Texas is generally stated in terms of a presumption, a presumption that common law principles are incorporated, and a standard as to when that presumption can be overcome, namely only if the regulations speak directly to the question and that they make evident the intent to exclude common law principles. So under either a burden of proof perspective under the Mader decision in the Second Circuit, or from the perspective of what the presumption is and how that presumption is overcome, we believe under either approach the discharge rule applies.
May it please the Court, John Arbab on behalf of the Secretary. Your Honor, in the government's view, the common law is really irrelevant to this case, because Noble hasn't proved that there's a common law rule to the effect that if the government breaches a contract, then the government can't exercise its police power over the non-breaching party.
Appellant doesn't have to prove that, because that isn't any part of the appellant's claim.
Your Honor,
his claim quite clearly is that the regulation should be interpreted in a way for a situation that the regulation does not contemplate, or certainly does not explicitly mention, in a way congruent with the common law.
Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that the focus of the appellant's argument is based on the U.S. versus Texas case. The premise of a U.S. versus Texas analysis is that there is some well-settled principle of common law that it was so well-settled that when Congress subsequently enacted a statute, or when an agency subsequently promulgates a regulation, this very well-settled common law background rule ought to be interpreted as having been carried forward into the regulatory scheme.
Your argument is that the discharge principle doesn't fit into that category?
Your Honor, the discharge principle is a principle of contract law, and that only speaks to what happens when one party to a contract
breaches the contract, does that discharge the non-breaching party of its obligation to go forward with the contract? And the answer is yes, but that is not the situation we have here.
Even when you have a set of regulations which is exclusively devoted to regulating the lessor-lessee relationship in this very specific context?
Yes, Your Honor, because the government, first of all, the common law does not speak to the question that's before the court. The question before the court...
The question is.
I submit that and the way we view the case is that the question before the court is, let's put it exactly in U.S. versus Texas terms, because that's the framework of the appellant's argument. The question would be, prior to the enactment of the OXLA or these regulations, was there a common law principle that when the government breaches a lease that it has with a regulated entity, the government not only has to pay damages for breaching the lease, but also, in essence, loses its right to exercise its police power?
Clearly, you can manipulate the idea of what the underlying common law principle is in such a way that it excludes application. And you've done a good job on that. Let me focus on section 1711, which deals with when MMS will order me, as the regulations in their folksy way say, to plug a well. When it poses a hazard to safety or the environment, I don't think you're resting on that, or is not useful for lease operations and is not capable of oil, gas, or sulfur production in paying quantities. Now, suppose that we have a lease that's producing one of those three in paying quantities lavishly, and the government sends a group of PT boats to the rig, explains to everybody that if they do not get off in 24 hours, they will be blasted, and that no humans can return to the rig. And at which point, production shuts down. Then the next day, the government, MMS, issues an order, plug the well, no problem. Section 1711, fully applicable.
Your Honor, if the language of the regulation covers the situation, then yes, it would be applicable. But
you really will go for that. Government troops preclude entry and preclude entry for drilling purposes. I assume they'd have to allow entry for plugging purposes, and that regulatory obligation persists.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that this regulation 1711 would cover the hypothetical that you're raising. But if I could just focus back on this.
Well,
case.
You pin your case on literal application of the regulation. I just want to know how far you take that.
Well, I don't think the government or the court needs to take it any farther than MMS actually did in the order that's under review, where cited.
Yeah, but we have background fact. The background fact in our case is discharge, right, of lease obligation,
yes.
Right? And we have legal action preventing the lessee from exercising its lessee rights, right? I've substituted military action, but on the principle that you're advocating, I don't see any difference.
Well, Your Honor, the government, by breaching the contract, did not give up its...
That's the conclusion, not the an explanation of the answer.
The government breached the contract, breached this lease. It paid damages for that breach. The question is, is there a further consequence in terms of relieving the party from its regulatory obligations?
What is your test for determining whether a particular regulation is, as you say, independent of the lease? How do you look at, what do you do, and you look at a regulation, how do we know whether it's independent of the lease?
I think there's a fairly ready way of deciding that here. One of the only lease provision that is cited by the appellant is, I believe it's section 22 of the lease. That has certain language.
which is nothing like...
That the removal structures?
Yes.
But that line, it also says in accordance with applicable regulations and orders of the director.
Yes.
Doesn't that link directly the regulations we're talking about here with the lease provision?
Well, in my view, it shows that there's an independent and separate existence of a body of regulations.
See, that doesn't work, though, because of Section 1 anyway, that idea. That if we don't find it in the lease, then this regulation that we're looking at here, 1700 or whatever, is independent of the lease. But it doesn't work because this regulation is incorporated into the lease by Section 1.
Your Honor,
correct?
I don't think there's
any... Is that true or not?
I don't think that there's a principle of law that says if a government contract in the lease terms refers to or incorporates external freestanding regulations, then somehow those external freestanding regulations cease to have a separate existence apart from...
But they're part of the lease. This regulation is specifically incorporated into the lease.
Well, that's true, I imagine, of a great many government contracts.
What I find puzzling here is that in light of Section 1, and Section 1 also says that regulations for conservation promulgated after the lease is entered into become part of the lease, then I have a problem understanding how the California law, California coastal zone law, breached the lease. How can that be in light of Section 1?
Well, Section 1, Your Honor, is somewhat limited in the sense that it covers amendments in the future to the OXLA regulations that may be promulgated in the future under OXLA, but it doesn't specifically say, you know, other amended statutes such as the Coastal Zone Management Act, and that was the problem in cases like Amber Resources and Mobil Oil. In the
Mobil Oil, right?
Yes,
because the regulations in Mobil Oil came after the lease was entered into. But we don't have that problem here.
No, but Your Honor, if I could try to get back to your question about do the regulations cease to have an independent existence if they're carried into the contract by a contract term, I can point out that the regulations in many places expressly distinguish between lease terms and regulatory obligations, and I think that is strong evidence.
Regulations do that, you say?
Yes, I can give you a number of examples. For instance,
do any in the 1700 series do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
The plug series?
Yes, and in other regulations within that chapter.
Okay, show me.
30 CFR 250.1710, which is reproduced at addendum 10 in the red brief, states that you must permanently plug all wells on a lease within 1 year after the lease terminates. I mean, that suggests to me that
That suggests termination of the lease in the ordinary course of lease termination.
Yeah, the time ran out.
Yes, Your Honor, but my point is here that this recognizes that there's a difference between the contract being in existence or not and a regulatory obligation independently persisting or continuing after the lease is over. You could also
There's no official interpretation of the plug requirement by Interior, is there?
In this case?
In the context of this case, when there's been a material breach, I mean, there's no official interpretation by the Department of the Interior.
There isn't, Your Honor, and that is because of the way appellants decided to challenge the order that's before the court. On page 17 of the red brief, we point out the order where MMS found MMS has determined that there is no longer justification for maintaining the well in temporary abandoned status, therefore, as required by the regulations.
Well, that is,
but the important point is that Mobil's response.
You know, something just occurred to me. Why isn't that an official interpretation of the regulation? That letter.
This is
a formal interpretation.
I would say that is a finding that in this particular case, there's no longer justification for maintaining the well in temporary abandoned status. That's not being challenged here in an APA sense at all.
Was that issued after the lower court made a determination that there had been a material breach?
This order was issued about 1 year after the Federal Circuit opinion in Amber 3.
So it's issued in the face of a decision that there's been a material breach.
Yes, Your Honor. But
so why isn't that interpretation, I mean, you haven't argued this, but why isn't that interpretation satisfactory in Meade terms or whatever, that it's an official interpretation of the regulation into which we Chevron deference?
I have to admit I didn't think of it in that way, but I agree with your point. The point I was
– I would think so, yeah.
The point I was also hoping to make was that Noble's response was to go directly to challenge that order by going directly to district court. In other words, the administrative process that it could have chosen but wasn't required to would have resulted in an IBLA opinion that presumably would have fleshed all of this out a lot more than the MMS order itself. But Judge Randolph, as you point out, I mean, that could be regarded as the agency's interpretation of how these regulations ought to be applied in this particular situation.
Even though it doesn't say so in so many words, I mean, there are Chevron deference cases, well, there are cases, was it the Norfolk and Western case in the Supreme Court where I think it was the predecessor, I think it was the ICC back then, I'm just announced this is what this regulation means with no analysis whatsoever. And that's another question. You know, we've got a line of cases that say that that say there has to be some sort of an analysis so we can be assured that the appropriate weighing was done in terms of policy and so on.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the MMS order under examination here falls short of that, I think, because of the way this case was litigated, it went directly to the district court. This order of the MMS was the agency's only opportunity to say anything about the situation here. There was no IBLA analysis that would have been much fuller if the case had been appealed administratively. But in any case, I mean, the Supreme Court doctrine is also pretty clear, I think, that at least in a situation like this, when the government's first real opportunity to explain itself, as it were, is in court, then it's fine for the agency position to be presented in a brief.
My recollection is that your brief doesn't really focus on AMRO or AMICO in your effort to distinguish all the Texas doctrine cases. But do you want to try it here?
Sure, Your Honor. I think the case that appellant places the most emphasis on is probably the AMRO case,
right,
which is a decision of the Court of Federal Claims, if I'm remembering correctly. And there you had exactly what you don't have here, which is a very well-settled common law principle dealing with how you handle forged checks or double forged.
But it doesn't deal, that common law principle doesn't say that government regulations to the contrary are to be set aside, right?
No,
which I think is what you demand for this case.
No, Your Honor, I think that that what we demand for this case is some showing that there was a common law principle of discharge from regulatory obligations that was...
That's exactly what I'm saying. In this case, you say it's got to be a common law principle involving discharge from regulatory operations, but AMRO and AMICO both involve common law principles purely in the private sector that then are used to contradict the precise language of government regulation.
I disagree with that characterization, Your Honor, because to take AMRO, for example, the very well settled common law principles going all the way back to the 18th century in the English case, Price versus Neal cited in that case, and also carried forward into Supreme Court precedent from the 1800s,
Government regulation that made no provision whatever for the double forgery case.
But the question there was, later on, the Treasury Department promulgates regulations. The question before the court in AMBRA was, the government was arguing for an interpretation of its regulations, which the court said would have overruled Supreme Court precedent and would have essentially nullified the English rule.
Only in the sense that it would have produced a result which, had the case been a common law case, would have been contrary to settled principles.
Right, but the question before the court, Your Honor, was given what the effect on the settled law would be if we accepted the government's interpretation, is the regulation clear enough?
No effect on the settled common law if the court had accepted the government's interpretation there. No effect whatever. The only effect was on the meaning of the regulation and its application.
Well, Your Honor, the way the court viewed the question before it in Amro was, and I think the court was quite explicit about it. I can try to cite to the exact. I'm not sure that. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. In Amro.
What page are you on?
I think the most relevant part is on page 132, the opinion. 34 Federal Claims Reporter at 132. In the second column, captioned Roman numeral 6, about halfway down, the court explains that if it were to accept Treasury's interpretation of its regulations, that would overrule the result of Chase National Bank, which is a very old, I think, 1920 Supreme Court case, but it would also supersede the rule of Price.
I'm sorry, would you repeat the page you're on again?
I'm at page 132 of Amro, which is 34 Federal Claims Reporter.
Okay.
To accept
as a literal matter, that's untrue. Let's face it. It wouldn't overrule any common law case whatsoever. It would just apply an interpretation to the regulation which was inconsistent with the common law rule.
Well,
totally different.
Well, the court was operating within a U.S. versus Texas format here.
Yeah.
And it was concerned, as the court said, that to accept the government's regulatory interpretation would overrule the result of Chase National Bank and would also supersede the rule of Price.
Chase National Bank's not an interpretation of this regulation, right?
No, but that's our point here, is that the analog to Chase National Bank and Price, the 18th century English case, is missing here.
The doctrine of discharge totally disappears in your analysis.
No, Your Honor, our point is that...
For the precedents that you're confronted with, you say, oh, well, they're big precedents against the outcome there. For our case, you say, there's nothing about the discharge doctrine that applies to regulations. But that was absolutely equally true of these precedents.
Well, Your Honor, that just shows, in my mind, that why these numerous U.S. versus Texas applications are not relevant to this case, because let's just look at the restatement second of contracts, which Noble places so much reliance on. They cite section 237 of the restatement second of contracts, and yes, that states a principle of just discharge from contractual obligations, but that doesn't speak to anything beyond that. And in fact, the introduction to the restatement says, we're not attempting to state rules.
Let me just go back a moment. You will concede, I hope, that in both those cases, Amro and Amoco, the court arrives at a conclusion that is flatly inconsistent with the literal language of the regulation.
Your Honor, yes, in the sense, but the premise of reaching that conclusion was that the court was satisfied that there truly was a settled common law principle.
But there wasn't a settled common law principle about the regulation. There was a settled common law principle, period.
That's right. But the question is whether it was clear enough in those cases that the regulation was intending or should be read as having overruled very well settled common law principles. But here the background principle of this case is really the sovereignty of the United States and its ability
I think everybody in this room knows and understands that if the government issued a regulation saying that no matter what the behavior of the government in terms of totally breaching the lease, it is free to insist on the lessee bearing the burden of plugging the well, none of us would be here.
Well, Your Honor, the question is why should the government, why is it reasonable for the government to issue regulations that cover situations that the government hopefully will never be in. it would be, I think it would be odd for agencies to promulgate a regulation saying, here are the regulatory consequences of our hypothetical
maybe
breach of contract.
Maybe it would be more honest, that would be, as opposed to arguing that that after the government has outrageously misbehaved, nothing has changed.
Your Honor, the government breached the contract, and it paid quite dearly for it in the Amber Resources litigation, over $1.1 billion in restitution to the lessees.
Well, actually, the Congress breached it.
Or the Ninth Circuit breached it.
Yeah. Well, it was found that the government had breached the contracts in an effort to come into compliance with the judicial interpretations of the Coastal Zone Management Act. But I think the point here is that the government was sued for breach of contract. Noble and the other lessees in Amber prevailed, and the government paid a lot of money in restitution.
I don't know how far. The government just gave back what the companies had already paid it, right?
That was the remedy that they elected, that the lessees elected.
I know, but so the government had the use of their money for how many years?
I don't remember. It was for a fairly long period of time.
Yeah, $1.1 billion. Did they get interest on that?
I'm not sure. It may be that in that situation, the government simply has not waived its sovereign immunity for interest.
The government made out pretty well here.
Well, I wouldn't view it that way. giving back $1.1 billion is certainly, I mean, it was the remedy that the lessees in that case elected. They could have elected a different remedy, but they didn't.
Sir, am I right in thinking that the government said, with respect to well plugging, that it would be premature to address the costs of that?
Your Honor, I know that in the reply brief, an argument is made to that effect based on an interrogatory response, but Noble says that interrogatory response in the CFC somehow disabused it of something or another. And I mean, I think what counts here is what the rulings of the CFC were, not what the government said or didn't say, or how you interpret a discovery response. But the central point here, I think, is that yes, the government breached the lease. That was found by the courts.
I mean, I have it in front of me. It's page 11. Yeah.
The government makes no bones about the fact that it was found to have breached the lease. The question here, and it paid the appropriate remedy, which the lessees were asking for. But the question here is, does that breach have a further effect of, in our view, making it impossible or divesting the government of its authority to continue to exercise its police power with respect to this lease? And we think the answer to that question is no, because, I mean, that is, in our view, the background principle is that principle of federal law, not of common law of contracts. It's the principle that's enunciated in many areas of federal law, like the sovereign acts doctrine, the unmistakability doctrine. It's the one that we also discuss in the red brief that's recognized the distinction between proprietary action by the government and regulatory action by the government in the national labor relations preemption area. It's also, it's not cited, but it's the same principle in federal Indian law that the Supreme Court has recognized in Marion versus Hickory Apache, 455 U.S. 130 at 145-46, where the court, Supreme Court admonishes.
Case?
Excuse me?
Is that the ski resort case?
No. Marion had to do with the ability of an Indian tribe to levy a severance tax on lessees that extracted oil and gas from the reservation.
Yeah, and cotton patrolling. Yeah, go. And
in Marion, the Supreme Court, akin to the other areas of federal law I just mentioned, admonished against confusing the tribe's, quote, role as a commercial partner with its role as a sovereign. So the background principles of federal law, which we submit the court ought to be focusing on, are these principles, which distinguish the government acting as a contracting partner or as a proprietor from its role as a sovereign that has responsibility on the Outer Continental Shelf for making sure that the shelf is safe for other users of the waters beside Noble and lessees, and also to protect the environment for other people beside the lessees.
Is there a federal severance tax on the Outer Continental Shelf?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I do know that the agreements.
All right, I just wondered. Go ahead.
The agreements provide for royalties to be paid by under federal law.
Do you have a case where you have a set of regulations uniquely applicable to a particular contractual relationship of the government and a private party, where a court allows the government to apply what you call the police power without, in the face of a claim that the at common law, the principles which govern this contractual relationship would absolutely bar what has been enshrined in the regulation. But despite that, the government is allowed to forge ahead on it? I don't see any case at all like that in your brief.
Well, Your Honor, we view this case as the relevant background principles against which the regulations should be interpreted are the ones I've just described of federal law. But if I could return to another theme that I think gets to this point.
Maybe I take the answer to my question, no.
Your Honor, I think the answer to your question is no, because of what the regulations actually, how the regulations are structured. And as I was saying earlier, the regulations make quite clear the distinction between lease terms and the regulatory terms that are set out in the relevant regulations here. I cited one, 270.1710, which I think Judge Randolph was not terribly impressed with, but there are others that are also cited in the brief that I would ask the court to take another look at. 30 CFR 256.62E1, which is at Red Brief Addendum 20, the regulation states that an assignee of a lease or an interest in a lease must, quote, comply with all the terms and conditions of the lease and all regulations issued under the Act, meaning under the OXLA. So, I mean, the regulations are making a distinction between lease language, the lease, and the regulation.
The government can save a certain amount of paper by putting the lessee's obligations into a regulation as opposed to duplicating them in a lease, right? So why should that paper saving have any impact on the proper approach to the case?
Well, I think the question is what do the interpretations say? The argument here is that there really is no difference between the contract terms and the regulations, which we view to be independent and freestanding, because the contract refers to the regulatory obligations. I mean, I suppose that could be the law. I really don't know.
I don't read the plaintiff's claim anywhere near that broad. But any regulation referred to in a contract with the government falls with the contract.
Your Honor, I think that's exactly what they're. I mean, it's not their main argument. Their main argument is U.S. versus Texas. But one of their subsidiary or variations on the theme, you might say, is that the discharge ought to be applied here because the lease language, Section 22 of the lease language, is virtually identical or identical to the regulations. And, you know, if, in other words, there's really no difference between. I mean, this almost gets to be metaphysical, but I mean, ontologically, the argument is that there is no separate existence of the regulations in 30 CFR because they're referred to or incorporated by the contract.
It's the first time in 25 years that counsel in oral argument has used the word ontological.
Well, that's what happens when you major in philosophy as an undergraduate. It never gets away from you. But I think that's really, it's a sort of a metaphysical argument here. I mean, the fact is that the regulations are out there. They've been in the Federal Register and in the CFR since 1954, 1 year after OXLA was enacted. There has always been, ever since 1954, a basic permanent plug and abandonment requirement. Everyone knows about this. And as I was saying, there are any number of regulations that we cite in the brief, which expressly distinguish between contractual language and regulatory obligations.
Great. Okay. If we, my colleagues have no further questions, let's.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate all the time.
Okay. Says you only have 2 minutes, but given the amount of time we gave to the government, why don't we give you 3 minutes and let's see what sort of questions we have.
As Judge Williams' questions revealed, in AMRO and AMICO both, regulatory requirements that on their face appeared absolutely clear were interpreted to reach the opposite result because common law principles were read into them. We believe that under those conditions, that being the proper application of the Texas rule, and of course the government won the AMICO case based on those principles, the same result should happen here, namely these common law principles of discharge should be read into the regulatory and statutory scheme. It is not unusual, in fact it is commonplace, for courts applying Texas to take contract principles and apply them in a regulatory and statutory context. The offset rule, which is probably the most common application of the Texas rule, and was in the AMICO decision, but in some of the other decisions too, that's a common law principle. I mean, the principles of offset, it's a common law principle of contract. Offset arises in the context of debtor-creditor relationships. And yet that principle now applies in regulatory and statutory schemes involving tax obligations, for example. Similarly, in the insurance company, the West case, it was the common law applicable to the rights of an assignee that were used applying Texas to interpret the Tucker Act. Well, common law rights of assignees, that's contract law principle. Those are contract principles. So our request, our submittal, that contract principles apply here is nothing out of the ordinary. The closest the government tries to come to say there's a regulation that addresses this is the statement in the regulations that the obligation to plug and abandon survives termination. But as Judge William accurately stated, that clearly had in mind a normal termination. Furthermore, the regulations elsewhere talk about what termination mean. Termination can occur if the time runs out, one of your honors mentioned that example, or if the lease is canceled due to fraud, that's a termination, or if there's a voluntary relinquishment by the lessees. None of those circumstances apply here.
The important question for you is not whether you have to plug it. The question is who pays for it. If you got compensated, then you don't have a problem, right?
Well, we are obviously challenging both that we have to do it and pay for it. But I will certainly readily admit that the paying for it is a huge component.
Yeah, but the regulation doesn't say who pays. It just says who does it.
Right, but
Do you have any claim that remains after you expend the money to plug it, would you then have a new claim against the government for breach?
Well, I would like to think that were the case, but I'm challenged to see that. Because it's conceded that we have no contractual obligation to plug and abandon the well, and if we don't have a contractual obligation, I'm hard-pressed to see what the theory would be under which we have a claim against the government by having plugged and abandoned the well. And that, of course, is, you know, certainly the government's position. And as Judge Williams points out, the government was...
You prevented us from earning any money out of this thing, and in fact, we've just lost money because we had to pay $10 million of plugging.
Well, I think, you know, those are reasons why, in our view, the discharge rule should apply so that we don't have the obligation to conduct the plug-in abandonment at all. I mean, under any circumstance, it's going to be done by a third party. I mean, neither Noble nor the government have the equipment, own the equipment to do this. And it's a question of who's going to arrange for that third party, that drilling company, or however whatever method is used, to arrange for that company to come and do it, to get the, you know, and then to pay for it. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you very much. We have your arguments. Case is submitted.